Always record 120.
Hello, does this work now?
Yeah, you're working now.
Okay.
Yeah, I didn't make it as far as I'd hoped just because I've been tied up with some other things, but Green Man Earth Angel was a nice read so far.
Yeah, it's a good introduction to Henry Corbin, who is an author I've been pretty into lately.
Right, so it's his idea that, I guess according to this, he's moving past Jung in some significant way. Like, there's distinguishing spirit and soul, and I suppose that was a bit confusing at first, but then he just jumped to the chase and said, these mystical or spiritual forces are embodied on Earth, right? Is that the thrust of it? Obviously, there's more.
Yes, it's kind of hard to say exactly what he's saying. He seems to gloss over a lot of more detailed aspects of Henry Corbin's work. Corbin did say a lot of interesting things on that note.
It's not too long of a read either. There's a lot packed in there. So I suppose there's more I could read.
Yeah, there's another book called The World Turned Itself Inside Out. Let me look it up here.
Yeah.
It's not something like that. Not the Ola Tanga album.
Can you give a cliff notes of that one?
Oh, it's about the same subject, but it's just Tom Cheatham, who's kind of summarized in the other one. But I'm not sure if I should say everything about it at this point while everyone's not here.
We don't have to go there quite yet. It's up to you.
Yeah, I don't really know what I'm going to talk about here, so...
David always brings fuel to the fire.
Yeah.
So you think you'll want to talk about something you want to, but David will bring it into another direction, which will be equally interesting, no doubt, but
mm-hmm.
might not be where you want it to start. So there's no problem getting some of this out now, and then we can catch them up. Maybe they've read some of this. I don't know.
I don't know.
David?
Yes, sir.
Holy shit.
Well, it's only 9:09. I thought it was later.
You thought it was later?
Hello? Yeah. I connected with an old friend of mine who I haven't seen in years. Just spontaneously today. And so I just said goodbye, and I didn't know how late I was, but I didn't want to... Whatever. No, whatever. Hi, how are you guys doing?
Hey, what's up?
Hey.
Good.
Groovy. Are you recording, John?
I'm recording, but of course, if anyone can back up, go for it. It's never bad to have more than one, but I'll get the main one.
I like how, Jason, your picture is just solid white. I didn't even know. Did you actually put in, like, a white picture to
represent? No, I haven't configured this at all. I just installed it.
Okay.
On this MacBook here.
I see. I like that. I thought it was, like, the white album. I thought it was, like, an artistic statement of, like, he's the white profile or something. I don't know.
It goes with your away message, I guess.
I've been wanting to talk to you, Jason.
Yes.
So, I don't want to get this wrong. I want to know... who actually sent it my way. I believe it was one of our French friends, but he had been watching, I don't know the timing that he used or whatever the specifics are from his end, but he had taken Katy Perry's Fireworks and he had played it with Kenneth Anger's Firework.
Yes.
So no, that was like...
I have not heard of that.
He made this film like when he was 17 years old, I think. While his parents were away in their Hollywood house, and it's just like, it's ultra homoerotic, whatever, but it's really interesting in the context of like, you know, this would be a cultist, like, doing this whole thing, but like, it was really good. And I tried it a few different ways, just in terms of like, I couldn't listen to Katy Perry very easily on her own. Like, it's like I could stomach it, but it's not something I would be inclined to do, but I just love the context, presenting it in a different context and looking at it in a different expressive way. I don't know, I thought it was really cool. And then I ran some other experiments with Katy Perry stuff preceding that, and I don't know.
Her first album has some good tracks. One of the Boys. That has some good tracks on it. Not the other ones so much.
Mm-hmm. Well, this was Teenage Dream, right? And so that
right.
was Kenneth Anger's explanation for Firework is specifically... It's a teenage dream. Like, that's what he has to say about it. It's like, what it's to be a teenager, blah, 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 you know. But then also in the 4th of July. And so he's like, oh, being a teenager, 4th of July. And so, like, the songs have this kind of irony. So you're like, thank God it's Friday, which is a terrible song. Sorry.
No, it is.
It's a bad song. But it's really funny in the context of Kenneth Anger relating to thank God it's Friday. It's almost like his inner,
Well, from your studies of the Kabbalah, you should know that the Shekinah comes down on Friday.
That's right.
So even in this song, there's a certain archetypal framework at work in the background.
Exactly. Yeah, I totally dig it. It's steeped in mysticism for sure. I mean, there's no question there. In the first place, even with that kind of stuff aside, you know, just like what she's doing is extremely mystical.
I couldn't.
I'm not sure we'd go that far, but.
No, I actually think that there's way more that's being communicated in general. All over the place in pop music. I think it's become a standard. It's like a staple thing. Like, if you're going to produce, you know, that kind of Illuminati-esque shit, you gotta, you know, load it up with your,
I guess what I've always said is that these are our new gods. It should be obvious.
Right. Right.
Well, I think something really interesting about her song Dark Horse.
Yeah.
It really spoke to me, when it came out because, it really, to me, the whole song, it sings like, the Gnostic text, Thunder Perfect Mind. It sings like the way that reads, like, a Thunder Perfect Mind is like this great goddess, like kind of like speaking,
Dude, man, I was all over that back in like September of last year.
Before that.
You can always say that.
I am on the very leading edge of everything.
Yeah, like, I put up a Facebook post, but I don't know if I ever.
Before that was even a single. Like, when it leaked the first time, I heard that. I knew there was something there.
That's cool. Oh, yeah, no, it's totally there, man. If you open up to it, it kind of speaks to you.
September 2013. It's in that post. Reflective.
That's cool.
So it was JJ Draw. It was Jeremy from France who put that fireworks Kenneth Anger thing with the Katy Perry firework. It's impressive.
I saw a blog post about it. I'm not sure if it's the same guy. From like 2010.
Oh, from 2010. Oh, geez. Yeah. Huh. Interesting. I mean, it seemed like kind of, once I watched it, it was like an inevitability. You know, it's like, oh, well, this was about to happen. You know, I changed some of the songs around, because I liked the effect of, having Firework be able to play all the way through, and it ended up being, it was pretty impressive. It was very enjoyable. It was refreshing to listen to reconcile more pop music and relate to it in a different way, I guess you could say.
Well, send it my way, because I guess the one I'm seeing here is something else.
Okay. Yeah, it was on my, I posted a link to lasertits.com on my page, and it was in the comments that I'll drop that. So
I have not really been paying much attention to Facebook for a while.
Good.
I just kind of scroll quickly, and sometimes I say something stupid.
Right.
So I probably missed it. Nothing personal.
Almost everything I say is something relatively stupid, but it depends on who's, you know, stupid is stupid does, as the old saying goes, so, you know, whatever.
How old is that saying, by the way?
Many moons.
Yeah, I'm curious.
I believe it started with Forrest Gump, to tell you the truth. But
I think it did, too.
It's an obvious thing, because he's like, oh, well, if I'm stupid, then why am I doing all this cool shit or whatever, you know?
Well, yeah, yeah.
That seems pretty obvious, I guess.
Sure. Before you guys landed, Jason and I were starting to crack into this PDF file he sent me called Green Man Earth Angel.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like sort of a fundamental, at least from my perspective, it has some fundamental basis in synchromistic philosophy, that you can see the divine everywhere because the divine is a living thing, that there's spirit, matter, and imagination. Is that right, Jason? Like, it's a third element.
Right. There's a mundus imaginalis, and sort of this archetypal projection into our world of the purely archetypal realm, which is really what seeing these synchronicities is all about.
So, just to be clear, on just to qualify, when we say archetype, this is something that Jung's section of Man and His Symbols, because I was multiple authors, right? His section goes into, he emphasizes that he can't believe the amount of his students after years that still can't discern the distinction between an archetype and a symbol. Because they'll be referring to a symbol and call it an archetype again and again. He's like trying to make this, stress this very important point for him, which was
the symbol signifies an archetype, so.
Right, which is, for us, it's straightforward, we know this, but like, just to get on super basic level, you know, like, the point being is that you can never see an archetype in the sense of how we relate the scene, to be able to look upon something, to objectify it, in order to analyze it. You can't analyze an archetype, but you can analyze symbols, and the symbols represent the archetype or point to the archetype, but the archetype itself is always beyond, the expression that the archetype gives. Otherwise, it couldn't be an archetype, because the nature of the archetype is to be universal. And so if it has, you know, distinct expressions, those aren't the thing, they only point at it. So does that make sense? Is this?
Yes, yes.
Okay. Yeah. No, it's just a weird thing, because he's like, oh, well, we're analyzing the unconscious. And then he's like, you can't analyze, the subconscious is subconscious because it's like, it doesn't not be subconscious. No, I'm sure that was communicated wrong, but you know what I'm saying? Like,
right, but I think Corbin is kind of saying then that this unconscious archetypal realm then becomes outpictured in this world, and then by seeing that, then we become into closer contact with the ground of being and all that.
Right.
And understand how everything invisible is seen in that which is visible.
Right, but it's fucked up because there's nothing to hold on to. Like, that's the thing, like, that's the biggest challenge. That's why, like, I look at that and I'm like, well, you're telling me that the thing itself that you're pointing to can still only be inferred, no matter how much you build up on top of it. And so that has this whole thing around, like, sublimation, as far as I can tell, because it's the mind's ability to, like, fractal out and build on top. It's like an infinite recursion, in a sense, or it's like approaching the thing from all sides, but it's never actually touching the thing. It's like, that's what's, like, the motivating thing is, like, is that dynamic where you can't turn around and look at the thing. You can only represent it through all these different means. It's just, that's such a trip.
That, I guess that would be the essential Weltschmerz of our current predicament, is the of never seeing a true image, but only reflection thereof.
Right. Jesus. So
look it up, man. Weltschmerz.
I'm not familiar with the term. I heard you say it, and I don't know what. You dropped these terms, man. It's amazing. I love it. How do you spell that?
How do I get to the chat window here?
There should be a speech bubble that you can click on near the volume or connection button.
I don't know how this Mac Skype works.
Microsoft. I know. I don't know what these kids are doing with these fucking roller skates and Zima and Pac-Man video games, right?
It's a Microsoft ad. They don't like us. We're in the Mac.
What's this Green Man thing you were talking about? What are you looking at?
Oh, Jason sent me a PDF. It was a
tell title. Me more, tell me more.
Well, in reading it, it immediately struck me as, oh, this is synchro mysticism, or this should be a fundamental text as far as understanding where people are coming from in this movement, or certain people, because I'm not a good representative of that state of mind, but this is, it helps me put what other people do into a better perspective. I'll say that much. And it's not like I didn't have some grasp of that, but I'd never seen it, I guess. I hadn't seen that idea before coming into synchromysticism. So with any sort of art movement or intellectual movement, when you look at it, sometimes it's like, what is this? Because I don't know what it's based on. And you know, we have some ideas with like Wilson and McKenna and so on, but there's all these other subtle influences in the community that no one has any fucking idea about. And I didn't know about. And this is like one of them. And it's just cool to find it and to have it exposed to you that way.
Who's the author there? I'm curious about the author.
Jason, I don't know off the top of my head.
Okay, the author I was referring to is Tom Cheatham, and also Henry Corbin are the two big names, which I would type out for you if I could find the damn chat window.
I'll put out Corbin, at least. I can spell that out. Bam.
Hey, cool.
You know, when you look at, like, the representatives of, like, where we're coming from, because you say there's a movement, but with a movement, usually you have one kind of ideology, and then everything else is kind of, you know, following suit or whatever, but it's like, I would say Jay Kotza, lies on one extreme, and I would say our friend at Subliminal Synchrosphere probably lies on the other, in terms of, like, conspiratorial, like, this is what they're doing, you know, because they're both synchromysticism all the fucking way, right? I mean, Subliminal Synchrosphere, come on, right? But I would actually say maybe Jason lies in the center, because he doesn't actually take an ultimate position on what everything, like, in terms of, like, I don't know, people responsible or, like, you don't have the same kind of Illuminati kind of position taking necessarily, but you don't do what Jay Kotza does, where it's just all positive for the most part, even though it's heavy material. He still always leans towards this kind of ultimate spiritual positive thing, which I think is great. I mean, that has its place. He does it. He does it well. But yeah, you know what I'm saying? Like, there's this, like, almost perfect continuum that exists. Even if you don't accept those examples, you can just see there's this variance. It's a very dynamic network of takes on the same shit, you know? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but again, these people don't appear out of nowhere. They don't, their ideas don't usually, you know, what inspires them. I know how I move through whatever I consider my work and whatever is inspired by certain books and whatnot. It's just, I like going back to foundational texts, because I don't always like wanting things interpreted for me. And thus sometimes I feel like that's what I'm doing when I'm engaging with artwork, and I have no idea where it's come from, because people want to pretend they've done it or created it. And no, there's all these other people before.
Right. Like, you feel plagiarized when something, like, I'm sure Jason, you probably feel plagiarized quite a bit when people represent your ideas, but then have a different extrapolation of what they're taking from them. You know, I mean, that happens to me all the time. I came across it recently, and I don't always know.
I don't know. It's always like, I wish they had appropriated more most of the time.
There was just a fucking article, man, on The Shining, where they're like, The Shining is a biblical prophecy. But then everything that they were arguing, like, in the same order, was like what I had presented on my blog, as far as I can tell, five years ago.
Like that Subliminal Synchrosphere guy would do that as well, but he'd only take little pieces of it and not...
Well, Joe Cotta pulled out on it when he did it to him. And he ended up being friendly about it, but he initially was kind of like, what the fuck? Because he didn't know that Joe had actually written the thing. So Joe was commenting below his blog on it. And then he's like, and then Joe eventually told him, he's like, actually, like, you have everything I had to say from Back to the Future in a long sequence in the same order that I presented it. That's the thing that gets you sometimes. When it's in the same order, it's just like, oh boy, it's sure, like, you know.
Appropriating, like, media that other people have made, that it's hard to claim absolute ownership over any of it.
No, how can you own anything in the first place? I mean, that's the thing that's what I'm dealing with.
It's fucking, like, the ego says that it's the creator, but if it's not the creator, then you really can't claim ownership over anything.
Right. It's like there's a kind of Dutch door action thing happening here. Because on one level, I'm like, okay, well, I'm putting my stuff out there, but my stuff is all fucking multimedia shit. So, like, I'm pissed because I had the FBI, you know, terminate my Vimeo account of 36 videos that I put all this energy into, you know? But then at the same time, I'm like, you know, these people are plagiarizing me. They're taking my stuff. But then I'm like, well, I took other people's stuff in order to communicate something different that I was doing here. It's like, it's very convoluted. I mean, to me, ultimately, it feels straightforward, but I could see how, if you want to get into the specifics around it, it turns into a convoluted mess.
I like when people use, like, the material to, like, you know, even if they're exploring their own conspiratorial concepts or, like, synchromystic or whatever, like, I think that's always cool, and, like, I never mind whatever, you know, but, like, there's definitely been, like, at least two and, like, two, like, goofy, like, New Age guru dudes with their own website where it's, like, I think they're, like, trying to be these, like, life coach, like, you know, 2012 guru dudes, and they would, like, take, like, whole articles on Michael Jackson that I was writing and, like,
from live literally, from the Logosphere, like, and drop it.
Yeah. Yeah. They would, like, rewrite, like, my stuff about, like, how this hints at, like, you know, spiritual evolution and all this kind of stuff. And it's like, I would just at least like if, because those dudes are just like manipulating people into buying their crap, you know. So it's just like, sure. If they're gonna do that, I would at least like if they like offered people the source material, which is free and like, you know, whatever.
Right, but, or a fucking link, right?
Like, yeah, yeah. If you really are trying to, you know, and that's just the thing. It's just like if the work is out there for the sake of like yourself and everyone, then it'll be out there that way. And like, you know, so it's right. Just like, so,
speaking of which, really quickly, Kevin, Patrick and I are working on a blog right now. We're working on his blog, doing a thing on, Heather O'Rourke, Carol Ann from Poltergeist. Super cool. Heavy stuff.
The chipmunk girl.
Yeah. So
have you connected her to the chipmunk girl in Eraserhead?
Dude, no. I thought you were going to say something else, but whoa, what are you saying?
I'm interested.
I haven't seen Eraserhead.
I like it.
Forever. Lady in the Radiator, Lady in the TV, same thing.
Oh, interesting. That's, whoa. And then that could be a full circle thing too. I was going to say that at the top of the blog, even though it's not published yet, I acknowledge you and I was going to put a link to your specific page from Live from the Logosphere that we didn't necessarily take things from. We came, some of them we, you know, came across the same kind of shit, but we're not trying to put a particular spin on it necessarily, but it's really a difficult one because of the nature of the thing. So like, you know, the game from 8 years prior that there's a poster of on the kid's wall that she died. She got sick during the Super Bowl game. So it says 1988 Super Bowl
right,
above her
that.
Bed.
Yeah, yeah.
And then fucking when that Super Bowl actually happens, you know, the movie's like 1982 or something, you know, it's like years later, she fucking dies. But then I was looking at all this stuff, Rainbow Bright commercials that she was in. She was on this Disney special where she's on trial. She's going to be put to death. So she's a little girl on a Disney special and they're going to feed her to the alligator, Captain Hook's alligator. And it's a play on the trial from Alice in Wonderland. So it's as if she's Alice. So even
though
Alice
isn't
there or whatever, it's like they make Heather O'Rourke into Alice and they do this. It's got all these ritual elements. I mean, that's what I see. I don't know. I'm tripping out.
I'm glad you told me, because if you don't mind, I'm going to have to refer to our conversation really quick, because I'm editing Hypnosis from earlier tonight.
Mm-hmm.
And I just spent like 10 minutes on Heather O'Rourke. So if it's cool with you, I'd love to mention that reference you just made to that Disney show or whatever that is.
Oh, yeah, man. So did you mention the Super Bowl poster?
No, I didn't go quite into that, but it's the rainbow stuff. And I was equating her with like, you know, Alice and stuff like that. And
right.
Well,
she's Shekinah all the way. I mean, that's
what her
exile is in the house. Like, I think. You'd probably resonate with that, Jason. I don't know. You're not expected to resonate with that, but
well, in the lesser jihad, she's on the TV.
Right.
But on the greater jihad, she's somewhere else.
Right. I mean, there's all these things like the fucking MGM Lion roar for years was the roar that was produced from industrial light magic for the roar of the beast and Poltergeist. Like, literally, they made a sound bite, and then they used that sound bite for years and dubbed it over Leo the Lion. And so you have the Beast, trademark, you know, art for art's sake, MGM. That
it's
fucking
a Beast
lion.
Energy. Everyone worships the image of the Beast, you know?
Right. And I know I've gone into this on the show a bunch, and I don't want to explain the whole thing again, unless you guys are excited to hear it, but I don't think you are, but... the fucking ABBA thing with the MGM Grand burning down, there's all the evidence in the world for that being a ritual sacrifice thing. Like, I don't know how to deal with that. It's like you're going over this stuff and I'm trying to remain as objective as possible. And that's why I have sympathy for Horse Lover Fat, is because he fucking comes across this kind of shit. Like, he's the one, so I'm referencing him as well. You, Kevin, and him at the top of the thing, because I'm like, these are major pieces that you guys brought to the table, which you did, you know, looking at the address, you know, all this different shit, you know, Zelda, whatever, the Skittles lady, you know,
oh, yeah,
and he's like,
great.
And the father then, he's Coach Fox from fucking Fox, and I think Fox was on Fox, I need to look into that again, but like, you got 666 showing up there, it's the Beast in Poltergeist, he's the father in Poltergeist, he was Coach Fox in the show Fox. And so there's just this.
Fox is releasing Lucifer this week or something too, right? New show coming out called Lucifer.
Coach is coming back. They're bringing that show back.
Are you serious?
Yeah, I don't know why.
Ugh.
Coach Lucifer.
Fuck.
What a poor decision.
What a terrible decision.
You don't like that TV show? Craig T. Nelson?
Hey, you know.
Not my favorite.
Oh, that's his name. Thank you. I couldn't remember his name. Yeah, so that fucking guy. Yeah. So he's like, what side of the rainbow are we on anyway? You know, or whatever. Something, you know. And
it's so funny. I was just talking about that.
Yeah, because we're on the dark side. What side do you think we're on? What is this? You know? Like, so I don't know. There's some weird shit going on there. You know? I don't know. It's just, you come across things that are not, it's like, really? You made the fucking beast from the fucking movie into the MGM lion, dude. What the fuck are you doing? How symbolic are you going to push this? It's already Leo the lion, which is interesting in the first place, you know?
Devil's Advocate, Baby Tiger, some of his roles.
Wait a minute. Craig T. Nelson was in Devil's Advocate?
Apparently.
Really? I don't remember that. Huh. Whatever. I just remember Charlize Theron. And that monster video made by Jay Kotza is so fucking good. You know what I'm talking about?
That was
so good.
I miss these because this is make vlog posts about
them. He had two videos that I know of that were specifically all Charlize Theron. One of them was her, it's like, Charlie emphasizing the AA, which seemed to be a joke on Thelema, right, but I don't know if that was his intention. Yeah, must be his intention. It was the AA. She's an alcoholic, so it shows in every fucking movie she's in, she drinks like crazy.
That's the Babylon archetype, too. Right?
Well, she's Lilith in the Snow White movie.
Yeah, it's the lust card all the way is what's being communicated, and that's the whole point, because she's riding atop the beast, so Theron, you know, whatever it is, you know.
Right.
The great wild beast, and he went to town on it.
But she's like the evil blonde girl, opposing the good little brunette girl.
You have this Archie thing, which I don't completely understand. I think you have this Archie, it's not Archie, I mean, Archie is another example that you would use to communicate this phenomenon of the significance of the hair of...
It's a solar light. So we've got the blondness of the daylight opposing the darkness of the night. And so the secret here is, of course, that Satan is the ruler of the day world, which is very troubling to most people. But that's the secret of the whole thing, of Lilith and Samael ruling the other side of the tree, which is that this is the other side of the tree, being that the material world is Hades or hell. Right.
So I was thinking.
At least read the link post. It'll explain everything.
Yeah, you're. I can't. If I put my. You got it right here. 217. Okay, cool.
Yeah, it's totally.
I could read the rest of the fucking every day for the rest of the year, the next few years, and I could never get through your fucking blog post, man. It's a lot to read, which I guess was true for mine too. But I've stopped doing it, you know, and you're staying. Oh man, it's crazy. There's not enough time in the day. I read your stuff.
I like trash culture though. I love like the whole Tumblr trash culture. It's great. Like Twilight, that is totally my shit.
Yeah. Oh man. Well, this.
Hand. Maybe one of you, David or Kevin, maybe one of you know, because I saw a reference. I was just looking for some books today, and there's a book called, this is by way of 180, this has nothing to do with anything, it was called Beelzebub and the Beast, and it was on the meeting of George Gurdjieff and
I've looked at that.
Crowley.
Oh wait a minute, I haven't looked at that. All I've looked at is his Beelzebub book.
Did anything come of that meeting? Do either of you know what that was in the history of esotericism, if anything, or was it just this forgotten, awkward handshake and then they went their ways?
I don't actually know, but funny enough, I was reading about Gurdjieff just a few hours ago, and I feel like that may have come up, but I can't remember the details. I know he learned particularly from somebody, some mysterious character, all these like sacred Afghani dances or something. These sacred dances.
They're dervish. Dervishes.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Basically, dark.
And what's really interesting is that Gurdjieff was allegedly a spy.
Right, that's what like, they say, whatever. Yeah.
He certainly right. had the Same mustache with... of a spy.
Exactly.
That's a suspect mustache if I've ever seen one.
He looks like Super Mario. He's very much just Super Mario.
Well, he's the guy in The Wizard of Oz who's at the door when Dorothy knocks.
Yeah, that fucking guy. Holy totally.
Shit. And he doesn't let him in. But Gurdjieff that whole like thing that. Is just like a metaphor for his whole teaching. Because it's just like, he doesn't let any...
Yeah. Yeah, he's a, like, right.
And so Dorothy's asking for the esoteric gnosis, and he's just like, now go away. I'm not going to give you anything.
It's interesting.
She had to wait for summer of 42 before she could have that.
Yeah. Split the rainbow.
It's interesting. Spence
being a theosophist, you know.
Right.
Who's a theosophist?
L. Frank Baum.
The author of The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean,
And
one of the things I wrote, I think in my SyncBook article, I don't remember if it's in like a video or anything. Well, it's in some blog posts, but, basically like at the same time that Alice Bailey was writing her Rainbow Bridge, Antikorana like stuff that she was like getting from these Tibetan sources, supposedly, Baum was, you know, writing and working on The Wizard of Oz. And so they're both theosophists, like working on this material that regards like rainbows and dogs and dog stars.
Henry Corbin has a big thing about the whole emerald symbolism as well.
Oh, right.
You got your tablet right there. I mean, that's pretty direct.
City.
Yeah.
The Emerald City being the Nimbus Imaginalis as a sort of intermediate realm.
I always took it that it was
like
just
the Earth's most, like, I'm sorry.
I don't know. I was just like, the Emerald Tablet seems to be all over that fucking thing. That's why I was always kind of like...
Right. And so he does that in his novels.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting to think of, you know, Emerald... identified with, like, spring, and so I feel like it often represents, like, the Earth's most, like, I don't know, like, light, you know, like, the Earth's most, like, upright, illumined state or something, you know, like... I know there's some particular Crowley.
Well, according to Mr. Mark Claire, I mean, the moon in the middle is made out of green cheese.
Right.
So, I believe that's the true interpretation there. And if he's listening, I'm not making fun of him.
No.
What I want to know is if it's vegan. That's all I want to know.
He would laugh if he heard just that. It's moon cheese. He's a man who demands to be taken. Like, so seriously that you're in hysterics.
Like, I love everything he does. He thinks I'm making fun of him, but no.
Well, he's always on the lookout for his nemesis. As I've definitely pointed out to that I see, I'm like, you're a guy who likes to have a nemesis. And, he didn't deny it, as I remember, so. It's fun to have a nemesis. It makes you feel like, you know. Yeah, I get it.
And when you talk of like Gurdjieff letting someone in, I guess the only person he did was Uspensky, P.D. Uspensky, and I have I have his book, New Model of the Universe or something, just kind of sitting waiting to be read, and I'm chomping at the bit. But I was curious today, just in my mind, I'm like, I wonder what resonances exist between Uspensky and Israel Regardi, because in ways they were both defectors and both sort of in the inner circle, but I don't know.
Israel Regardi was more preoccupied with his profession. That's a weird thing. Like, he, I don't take him as any kind of, like, real authority. I don't take Crowley.
I read all of his books, and I never really learned anything about Kabbalah, I don't think.
Right? I mean, it's not, it doesn't actually get at the essence of what Kabbalah is really about, and that's really...
Isgard and pomegranates.
He was a great chiropractor. I mean, that was his main deal. He actually, like, I mean, a lot of people know who Israel Regardi is only in regards to his contribution to bodybuilding. It's really weird. In L.A., no less. I mean, that's the thing. Just in L.A., just like fucking Paul Foster Case or whatever. It's like these are the cultists of our contemporary times living in fucking Venice Beach.
Well, I think his work with the Middle Pillar was really good. And I also felt that the Garden of Pomegranates could have touched on a lot more, but I liked his more modern contributions. Like, I like, you know, I love Crowley and all these other older cats, but like, what I liked about Rigardi was his use of like the Kabbalistic model in relation to like modern psychology. And, you know, I don't blame him for it, but I see how he's also not like, he's not quite the same. He's not in the same exact current as a lot of these, like, you know, cats more like Crowley and, Grant and other weirdos.
Well, they're all making their own system out of another system. And that's the point. Like, it's, in its own context, it's good. That's why, like, I can say that about him, but I don't feel like I'm actually putting him down. Like, I respect his work.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I don't relate it to actual Kabbalah. Like, it's not doing the thing that Kabbalah is really designed to do necessarily, though it's pointing at it. Gotcha. It's misleading if somebody wants to look at that and say like, oh yeah, I know a thing or two about Kabbalah. Oh, did you read, The Garden of Pomegranates? Which is it's a reference to Ramach's Garden of Pomegranates from the 16th century. Which is what I study with my teacher, which is the irony of me looking at Israel Rigardi's Garden of Pomegranates before I studied Garden of Pomegranates written in Hebrew, you know.
Well, isn't Crowley misleading then by sheer equivocation?
Absolutely.
Okay.
That's what I'm saying. I put them in. I mean, they're both doing the same thing and they don't like each other. I mean,
well, the point of the great beast is that they're always going to be a deceiver. That's the MGM line again. It's the curse when you want to get to the center.
Mm-hmm.
I can totally agree.
I think also, you know, in a certain sense, I don't know. I guess I don't come from quite. I don't have a very thick Kabbalistic background, nor like too much heavy Hebrew or Torah knowledge, but I don't know. I guess I kind of feel more attracted to modernizations and stuff in that regard. I feel like Crowley, like a lot of Crowley's work is deeply Kabbalistic, but covered in everything else he was working with too, you know, but.
Right, right. I have to take Crowley in his supreme spiritual sense and not in the magical sense that he often took it himself.
Right, but the
so
thing
I
was.
So I kind of allegorize him as one with the Quran or whatever.
But it works. And
yes.
That's the point. Is and, that and, his what he's presenting
and,
works.
And you read something like The Vision of the Voice and everything in it is just really, just so on point.
Well, it puts him on, all this stuff really that puts him on par with people like William Blake, you know, and other, you know, notable visionary people. Because it's where the ego of Aleister Crowley and the idea of the guru and all these things fade away and this kind of, you know, that, like you said, the vision and the voice, it opens up the actual visionary universe that he was kind of, synthesizing through everything he was encountering, you know. So his work becomes a doorway into this current of consciousness interacting with the world, interacting with Kabbalah, interacting with, you know, all kinds of stuff. So, but I think the interesting thing to take from Crowley is, I guess the fact that like he ultimately only he's like a conduit for genius, you know, like, as like all artists are. So like, I feel like, you know, what was coming through him is something that's almost just like, it's in the category of genius and not in the category of like personalities or egos, you know. Certainly some of his writing from his personal, you know, standpoint carries different weight. But, of course, I think, you know, things like Vision and the Voice and other things he's done, they fall into that history of, you know, religious visionary prophecy that's, I guess got a lot of value, I think, outside of other dogma and stuff that comes with Crowley and et cetera, you know.
Is he genius or is he Janus? That's my question. Because the
Janus.
Motherfucker seemed to have multiple sides going on. Because I can't take a position
on that. That's the curse again of the Cry of the Six Aether, where the man in the center has to become a spinner of lies, and, except to those who properly understand them.
Oh,
and that's the whole allegory
also
in Harry Potter with the two Alastor Moody's.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, that was another one that I got into and thought about you the whole time. Not the whole
well,
time,
you
but you know what I'm saying. Like, your stuff came up a lot. Because I hadn't watched Harry Potter when they first came out for like a really long time, yet I read Mask of God, and so
I was
grateful
like,
to have read Mask of God before
J.K.
watching
J.K. Rowling really knows her theme. She She said that she's really studied that stuff. So it's, they're not like stupid.
Oh yeah, the Holy Guardian Angel is really, really vivid in the whole
Harry Potter's magic story. Is magic with a K.
Yeah, it sure fucking seems like it, doesn't it? I mean, there's so much there. It's like, from the very first episode, you immediately have, he's communicating with the serpent, he's got the fucking lightning flash on his head, so you got, like, serpent, lightning flash, connected, magic, every element, and then they show, it starts out with the lightning, like, you're like, lightning, 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 and then they're fucking serpent. It's like,
by the end, he gets the vision of his... I was just gonna say, but by the end he starts seeing his perfected self as this like almost 5D vision of himself in the future, like taking the right course of actions, and he begins to like follow that Holy Guardian Angel that he's seeing as himself doing the next task he has to do and stuff. And like when I was seeing that, I was just like, I knew for sure that there was really deep Crowleyan influence in that, you know.
And as that again is where you need some sort of humility to kind of see what's really going on with popular media and not dismiss everything as just some sort of childish foolishness.
Seems like he was smart enough to know how to work sensationalism and really just like, just fucking go for it. If you want your name to stick, like no, like he spent his entire fortune on publishing his shit. Like we wouldn't know who he is if he wasn't extremely prolific and pumping out books that he himself paid for entirely to have made at all. You know, it's like, it wasn't, you know, there was no like publishing company being like, oh, can we publish your stuff and give you the, like, no, it's like he just paid to have his stuff printed. Simple as that. You know, that's a kind of a different technique.
In fairness, he was a trust fund baby. It's not like he was busting his ass to get these things published.
Shit. It was all
and a lot of his financial misfortunes because he didn't know how to handle money at all.
Yeah, but he definitely could have spent his life as a full on, like, as he would say, dog, you know, he never had to rise, you know, into the realms of poetry or magical discipline and stuff. And so, I think something was really pushing in that guy. I mean, just as it is with all of us, you know, it's like, I, that's the way I look at him is like, there's so many ways to look at him and the things he'd done and all these different things. But when I look at what was going on there, I just see this dude who's like supercharged trying to take in all this stuff while knowing it's all illusion and transmute it into something. And he managed to say a lot, that hadn't been said and couldn't even be fathomed by most, you know? And so, I mean, I still feel like he's an absolute hidden gem of, you know, of like reasonable apprehension in a lot of senses. I mean, you know, just some of the volatility of his perception on human liberty and man's godhood and all these radical concepts that really need to, rise to the surface. I mean, you know, his work is, it stands alone almost, you know, so.
Well, I would say the opposite thing. It didn't actually stand alone at all. I would put him more in like the continuum of the Western esoteric tradition. And I think if you really read him in the context of that, you can better appreciate him without putting him on like a singular pedestal. And
I would totally agree.
Like, if you read any of the Western mystics, or if you read, like, even Ibn Arabi, or Henry Forbin again, or, like, Jacob Brehm, or whatever, I don't know. Like, I regard him as an interesting commentator on the hidden world, but not as the supreme authority on it.
Mm-hmm. And there's always, again, in our culture, it's like, did Beta win or did VHS win? And the same way with occultists, it's like certain ones are remembered and other ones are forgotten. But
did Krishnamurti win or was it Aleister Crowley? I don't know.
That's a fair
I think, yeah, they're still competing out there in the world, you know.
Well, they're the ultimate corollaries. Like, they're so almost mutually interdependent at the same time. I know I've said that before, right. But I really, like, I'm like, one guy doing everything he can to not take on the label and then ending up becoming the thing. But then the other guy is doing everything he can to become the label and becoming like the antithesis to the thing that he's trying to become. Yet I don't know how to explain it. They're like these two trying to not be the thing, trying to be the thing. Like, I don't know. They're like direct mirrors of each other in this really weird way, which is interesting then to think about just the relationship between Thelema
and
theosophy. Because, like, because Krishnamurti was raised by the Theosophical Society and was prophesied by the Theosophical Society to be the world teacher, which is what I'm referring to. So isn't right. it weird then that, like, Theosophy and Thelema, and, like, it's so funny, like, if you look at, like, the discussion boards and stuff around, like, Theosophists meeting Thelemites, they're like, there's some, you know, the more simpler ones are like, no, we're friends here, we're all, you know, and then there's some of them are like, no, these are completely non-compatible things, and I don't really know. They're like, oh, well, what would Crowley say if he saw Mount Blavatsky? He would, like, you know, they would hate each other. I'm like, did they hate each other? Do you guys know?
No, he probably liked her. He wrote a commentary on her stuff.
It's just funny because people will make those kind of comments a lot, you know, where they're like, oh, Crowley would fucking piss on her shit. And I'm just like, what are you talking about, dude? It seems like they'd be pretty, I don't know, but they're, it's so interesting to have two antitheses actually be so compatible. It feels like that's intentional. It's like the end of I Heart Huckabees when he's like, you gotta be working for him, cause how the fuck could this, you know.
Well, I think that's the bitter truth about Crowley was that he wasn't, you know.
Kevin, are you still there?
Oh, he's gone. Okay. I thought he was just processing.
He officially dropped.
Oh, man. And he was about to say the fucking secret of the universe, man. Maybe it just happened like what happened to Kennedy, like Mark Leclerc said, and he just figured out the secret of the universe and his head just exploded. We'll find out Jackie in a few days. What's that?
I heard Jackie did it.
You heard Jackie did it? Yeah. She had a fucking bomb around his collar that she, you know, I don't know. I just, you know, I think that that's a stronger argument than a lot of the arguments, is that he just figured it out and his head just exploded. And that's what we're seeing.
I prefer the Battlefield Earth scenario where he had a secret dog collar on and blew.
Really? Is that what the Battlefield Earth scenario?
Have you not seen Battlefield Earth?
No, man, I don't watch, I don't see things. I don't know, I saw Melancholia, that was pretty good, but I don't really.
It's like, I don't know.
Battlefield Earth has Scientology premier John Travolta as the lead bad guy, and it's filled with all these big names, and it was just the worst thing ever, and based on I think an L. Ron Hubbard book.
Oh really? Is it directly?
Yeah.
So I was wondering. I mean, it's, yeah, I don't know.
It's basically Scientology propaganda in its way. It is and it isn't. You know, it depends on how you view it. If you, I don't know.
Man,
I guess that's the same way I'm getting scared. People like Christians are getting scared of Harry Potter. Oh, that's Scientology propaganda. Well, yeah, it's made with certain agendas in mind, but
I don't
nothing's
going
to brainwash you.
I don't know. I have some strong possible feelings about what Scientology could be.
Well, Kevin, finish your thought, and then we'll let David defend Scientology.
Where did I get lost there?
That's a good question.
You were about to drop the secret of the universe on us, and then I assumed your head just exploded. But
yeah,
I think
there are forces that like to get up in the mix.
I thought you were finishing a thought on Crowley, but I could be wrong.
Yeah, I'm not sure where I cut out, but I was just saying he's kind of a bittersweet spiritual guru, but I don't consider him a guru. Is what I was getting at is, you know, I think he was very honest about his humanity, and he enjoyed everything that came with life, without being full of shit, like a lot of these gurus end up being, about their sexual lives and about their consumption of drugs and alcohol and all this kind of stuff. So I was just saying, I think it's great that Crowley, you know, found himself this person, you know, channeling this work, and he took on this title of, you know, beast or magus in order to communicate this spiritual, you know,
much like the MGM line, communicates spiritual truth.
right, absolutely. I mean, isn't it perfect that like this beast roars at the beginning of every like creative
much like
presentation? You know? Right, like, yeah. But yeah, that's all I was trying to just get across there was like, I think Crowley was an honest, you know, person, putting his work out there and being who he was for the most part. And that the last thought that I had was, I think I lost it.
You need more weed.
Yeah, it's been a couple hours, right?
You're sure you need to do something about that. Usually helps. Tell you.
Yeah, I don't know. Last time I totally lost the couple thoughts. But
penny for a thought.
I respected him that he brought chemical. He was willing to bring what was referred to as chemical gnosis. I like that word for tripping. And anyway, in when he started getting into, what was it? I think it was, I'm forgetting the exact organization's name, but he and Alan Bennett, who's an interesting fellow who I don't think is talked about at all, but he would...
What, the Magus guy? The guy who wrote...
I don't know what he wrote, but I'm pretty sure. I mean, he was basically, he's the one that told Crowley, get into Kabbalah. He's the one that told Crowley, hey, I have a bunch of psychedelics.
Yeah, he was like a, yeah, climbing buddy, right?
Yeah, and that violated all sorts of norms and... So I respect his willingness to, yeah, kind of like what Kevin said, just like be open and be like, yeah, I think this actually has a tradition. And he was a bit hedonistic at times, but whatever. I appreciate certain hedonists. I just don't think there's any point to go to Italy and fuck a goat, but it's like to each their own.
That's not the fucking goats. That's
this
not
is not what happened. Let me tell you, the goat came out of him.
If anyone can find the evidence of that, I'd be totally happy to.
That's why I said I only read him in an esoteric manner.
I love the character comparison to William Blake. I thought that was a nice one.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You had a thing for goats.
Yeah, I mean, but... I think every person is a visionary genius to their own degree, you know? So, like, I feel like Crowley, to me, just looks like one of these dudes who just, like, for whatever reason, like, was just supercharged to, like, tear through life and, like, take in all this stuff and, you know... Certainly people could say it went to his head here and there, and that can certainly be alluded to in different ways. But I think that's the biggest trouble of a lot of the stuff is, you know, like, as it's said in the mystery schools, you know, like the word of the adept is often kind of muddled by, what they would say is like the ape of Thoth, you know, like by the virtue of Mercury and the nature of language and understanding itself, because, you know, language is just this mediation of how we can communicate certain experiences to each other and then try to have this valuable appropriation of information in response to that, you know? So like, it's a lot of Crowley, especially that's why the Yellow Press just, you know, tore him apart, and they loved, all the different things they could say about him and allude him to. Because I mean, especially not being even the mystical students that approach Crowley's work, myself included early on, you can't even begin to really get a hold of where he's coming from. You know, you see, you're reading these words that refer to all this, this allegory and all of this meaning, but it really takes your own direct experience and your own linking of your intuition to the very same model of the universe in order to really start to really understand his words. And I assume a lot of you guys have read, you know, a decent amount and stuff. And I'm not trying to like even act like I can discern everything the dude communicates. But, for me, there's totally veils of illusion between reading his early works and, you know, projecting my own superstitions and misunderstandings onto him. And, so I think that's another thing to consider too, is that, you know, the dude lived a very rare course. You know, he took on a very rare course of action that I feel alienates his ability to kind of communicate, in a broad sense, you know, so like, he's very easily misunderstood. He's very easily seen as this tyrannical, you know, volatile.
There's the fucking espionage side to it. And it's like, we talk about honesty with his personal life, but that's like next level. Like, but then at the same time, like the only way that I could possibly reconcile that in any way, which isn't a true reconcilement, is that like, you could say that, well, you know, there's the intention of the Freemasons that if you put it in their faces enough, and you keep it going enough, the fucking monomyth and all this shit, that eventually people will just start to wake up to what they're up to, and the whole thing will be exposed, and that's like, that's essentially the New Jerusalem. It's just like everybody aware of what everybody, you know, there's no more glass houses or whatever. And like, if you look at like his false flag event kind of thing and what has happened out of that, the magic is so make do. I don't know how to say it. It's like, it's just enough for it to work. It's like the septogram, where you're like, that shouldn't, that you look at that geometry and you're like, that shouldn't work, but it does, and it functions. And so like, that's what I'd say like about Crowley, is magic works. It's real working magic, but it's not real magic in the, it's like you're working with the interface and not the thing in itself, but that does its job, and you do it right,
right.
I don't know. Do you guys get what I'm kind of pointing at here? It's kind of weird, but.
I mean, no, I think that's the ultimate truth of Thelema and mystery schools and Crowley, is that this is all, kind of, I don't want to say temporal, but we're, this is all in process. So Thelema will surrender in its mystical lineage to some other ultimate realization of the nature of reality in the mystery tradition, you know, according to people who ascribe to Thelema being the most, you know, current formulation of spiritual, I don't know, I don't want to quite say doctrine, but I think, you know, prophecy or
that's
spiritual.
It's a fucking doctrine. You can say that. Yeah. It's a total doctrine. Yeah, you know, look at the laws saying, for all. Talk about doctrine. Jesus fuck.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, it's the only kind of doctrine I could ever get down with is the one that says do what thou wilt. But, you know, that's the thing is I think. But yeah, it'll all turn to dust just like everything else, you know, so it's like, you know, to come to terms with what it's worth now is to contribute to its death. And that's right. Just like sync and like everything else we do in life is, as we create it, we're killing it, you know, at that same moment. And it's death is it's something else's birth, you know? So, I think it's great for people to have a healthy, approach to that. I think a lot of occultists don't even get that. There's a lot of people that are, they just think, you know, Crowley is this like fucking weird God being that's rare, this rare kind of God man. You know, it's like, no, that's not what he was saying. He's saying we're all God men. So, you know, he's dead. You know, who's the next guy who's going to open his mouth and say something radical that liberates us from, power structures and inherited, you know, dogmas and stuff. So, and even in the mystery school traditions of different schools, you know, it's just like, I don't know, people are locked into some weird shit. So I mean, excuse me, I don't know if I'm not trying to speak to anyone directly, but from my perspective.
What are you trying to say, Kevin?
Nothing about you guys, but you know, just like, you know.
Cats, so we're in the weird shit now, huh? Well, whatever.
Yeah, I'm the one who in an hour I'll be downstairs like, oh, coming in my, you know, 2 a.m. or whatever. But, no, but I wasn't speaking quite to you guys, but just some of these, you know, people in the occult community who they really bring a lot of superstition to the table and they make us look like a lot of goofy people who, believe in demon gods, like, you know, like this Baphomet god being who's different than any other deity that is special. I don't know. There's like, just like, you know, Thelema culture, occult culture, there's a lot of weirdness just like there is everywhere, but, I think the people who really grasp
smoking, from what I understand, if you go to the OTO meetings, is just like a lot of meth. So I've heard.
I mean, I've been to a couple OTO meetings and lectures and Gnostic masses, and I feel the OTO lodge here in New York, everyone there's great. Like, I don't want to say characters, but there's an array of different kinds of people who are really pleasant and, they've given really good Kabbalah lectures and masses. So I haven't seen anything to worry about there, but I have heard stories about maybe, you know, I think it was in the late 80s at that lodge, there was some heroin use going on and the guy passed away.
Depends on where you go. I mean, people come from different places with Thelema, and you'll find a lot of people take the do what thou wilt as like ultimate license to do whatever the fuck you want, even though it's repeated over and over again, but that's not what this means. It's all about finding the real will. What is my true path? You know, what being in the flow. But then it's weird because they're like, also, you ultimately, there is no, not the true path. And then you're like, what? Well, then why did you say that? It's like, well, because we're trying to distinguish between, you know, the, what is inferred and what is, you know, observable and to not to project onto something that's unknown as if it were the known and come to another place with it, all this kind of stuff. You know, it's like, oh, okay, well, that makes sense. You're just trying to tell me that determinism, as fate and chaos are actually mutually interdependent, but not trying to allow people to just relate to that in like a belief system or a conceptual way, but to actually put that to the test, put things in their place, see what that actually means experientially, and not just, you know, does that make sense?
Yeah, definitely.
Well, Kevin, you mentioned language somewhere in there, I'm forgetting where, and that just triggered something in my head, having read that Green Man, Earth Angel, or at least part of it. And Jason, I'll need you to clarify this for me, but he speaks of like living language, or in engaging whatever the third realm of imagination, that language and the exercise of imaginative language takes on like a different importance or quality. And so, like, you know, we're talking about Crowley and he was a poet, or Blake, or anybody. And, you know, from your writing and also like how you post on Facebook, there's a very singing poetic sort of imaginative quality to what you're trying to do, even in a casual post. And so I don't know if you've really, I feel like you've embodied that principle, and maybe correct me if I'm wrong. Is that like an influence on your work generally?
I think the only way to understand modern events is to maybe take them from more of an intuitive perspective, poetic kind of.
If somebody's relating to something as pretentious when it didn't give them anything in and of itself to be that, like, it's like, well, then that's clear where they're at, like, where they're, how they're relating to it is like a mirror of what they're projecting. Like, you can just see that.
Yeah, I guess
like
maybe there's a very fine line between the two that comes down to this sort of intuitive space.
But if it's just information, it's really all you're doing is showing information, showing different images. And so anything else on top of that, I mean, that's like that's what Zen is life with nothing added, right? It's the thing in and of itself, like Kant talked about. So it's like, your thing is a thing in and of itself. Like, your blog post is just a plain fucking picture, really. I mean, it's a bunch of different ideas, quotations.
It's a bunch of red lines drawn to each other on one of those insane person's bullets and bullets.
Yeah, your blog is very beautiful mind, to say the least.
That guy just got killed. Yeah.
Did he get killed, or what the fuck happened? Tell me about it.
Yeah, he and his wife just got killed in a car accident.
I thought he was gay.
That's like Russell Crowe and Jennifer Connelly in Noah's Ark.
Oh, shit, you're going to do that to me. Fuck.
So, you know, it's a perfect storm.
Oh, my God.
Dark Horse thing.
Interesting. And isn't it weird that the movie Dark Horse had this whole thing about a Jew studying Kabbalah, who, like, talked about Kabbalah? He was the son of Mia Farrow. So he's Mia Farrow's son.
I don't remember the Kabbalah part, but
that he tells the girl, he brings the girl home, and then he's all like, "I'm into mystical, things. It's called Kabbalah or whatever." And he like has this whole deal with it, and he's like, I think he even talks about Gematria. I don't know, I'd have to watch it again. But it's just weird because you got Katy Perry's Dark Horse, which has its whole occult thing or whatever. But then the film Dark Horse was like Mia Farrow's son, which implies
he's grown
up, and then her baby grown up is all talking about Kabbalah. He's a total nerd. I mean, it's not a good movie, but synchronistically, it was just like bam.
The guy gets killed in the end because you know.
That's right.
He should have known what he was falling for. And he played with Angela, and you know, Selma Blair Witch.
Right.
Right.
Interesting.
That's all I had to say about it.
Yeah, I was saying that the film Ghost Rider should have been called the Tony Blair Witch Project.
Yeah.
You get it? Because it's totally like the politician is very similar.
Yeah, well, he got killed by the goddess in that one as well.
Did he die? I can't remember.
Yeah, he got assassinated. Just like.
Oh, that's right. At the very end, that's the whole fucking point. Yeah.
Yeah, and you know, the woman was the real power behind the throne, who was manipulating everything.
Behind every great.
Just like Jackie telling you. Yeah.
I don't believe that that's true. Just to be clear.
So the Scarlet Woman is all power given, right?
Yes.
All power is given.
Yields up his ego to Babylon. And turns into the power of dust and all that.
All that fun stuff.
Oh.
Yeah, he becomes a Nemo.
Right.
That's the thing. Hey, are you familiar? Go ahead.
I was just going to say that movie Rango is all about the cup of Babylon, the water, and this Johnny Depp dead man gecko thing or whatever. He like totally encounters like all the three Scorpio archetypes as well throughout the film. I'll have to do, I don't know if I ever did anything on it, maybe just like a tweet or something, but.
What, the fucking scorpion, the dove, and the eagle or whatever?
Yeah, scorpion, eagle, and serpent, I think.
Oh, those that's the other. There's different understandings of that depending on where you're looking. I don't know what the ultimate origin way is, but yeah, I could see that.
Yeah. I think like three parts of the film, he like encounters these different characters that to me just seemed like these perfect, like, you know, archetypal encounters in that journey across the abyss to find water and all that. It's well, like, yeah, that was super cool.
So when he, in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, which this is like more than just connected to, like there's a whole thing going on there. There's a popular, well, I don't know how popular. There's a thing that people do where they watch Fear and Loathing, and then when he takes the adrenochrome, they cut to Rango, and then when Rango ends, they go back to where it left off in Fear and Loathing, and it's all one film. So it's like he's having this trip, and this is his trip.
Oh, that's so cool.
But like,
that's great.
But you could take it that, like, you know, I mean, first of all, he's looking for Lacerda in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. That's his contact. Lacerda is Latin for lizard, right? And what was the Portuguese thing? Oh no, it's Portuguese. You guys know what the fuck I'm talking about? Because when he finally meets Lacerda after he has this whole interaction with the reptiles in the restaurant, he's like, I was surrounded by a bunch of, you know, the fucking reptiles, you know.
Right. And
someone was giving booze to these goddamn things. It won't be long now before they tear us to shreds, you know. Yeah. But it's like after that he meets Lacerda, which is the fucking lizard, and the first thing he says to him, he's like, "You're not Portuguese, man." And when I looked up Lacerda, I guess I could look it up again. It's been a long time. But it had this whole thing around Portugal somehow. I don't remember what it was. There was another meaning or something. I can't remember. Sorry, I'm not keeping this together. It's the fucking thing.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. You should have all these facts in your head all the time. Never have I'm to sorry, consult a source ever.
I can't remember. I don't know, whatever. Fuck
you,
it.
You carried us pretty far. It's okay.
Okay, well, you know, I just noticed, I was watching The Big Lebowski again, and I noticed that there's even further whale references on the fucking, I'm sure all you guys all saw this, but you know when he signed September 11th on the thing, and then Bush is giving the speech that he gave on September 11th yeah. that uses the New World Order thing, and he's writing it on the fucking, filling out the check, there's a whale on the fucking check, which is interesting because he's listening to Songs of the Whales in his fucking bathtub when Flea bursts in, or no. Flea was in the bathroom with him earlier, and he licks the LSD off of his sleeve. But that, I'm jumping back and forth. I'm sorry. I literally will relate to different movies as if they're the same movie now in my head, because I'm intermeshing them so much that I'll be talking to somebody about a movie, and I'm already like talking about another movie as if it was that, if it was a scene in that. And so, Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers licks the LSD off of Hunter S. Thompson's sleeve. Johnny Depp in Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas in a bathroom. Flea from Red Hot Chili Peppers in The Big Lebowski bursts into the fucking bathroom while Lebowski is listening to Songs of the Whale on his fucking headphones, you know, or whatever. And so, and then he's sloshing around in the bathtub as if he was a whale or something. I mean, that's how I was relating to it. But then there's that scene in Fear and Loathing where fucking, you know, the attorney is in the bathtub and he's flipping around and he lifts up his fucking stick and he goes, "Don't fuck with me now, man. I am Ahab," which is a reference to Moby Dick, thus implying that the attorney in the bathtub is a whale and he's going to kill the white whale. You know, Moby Dick was a spiritual metaphor. Like Ahab looking for the whale is his own death. Like he's looking for enlightenment, not realizing that enlightenment is the death of his ego, and so he goes down with the whale, right? He becomes one with it.
I don't know, I never read it.
But anyways, yeah, you guys get what I'm saying. There's like some weird correspondences between Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas and The Big Lebowski in terms of like Flea and the whales and whatever the fuck they're trying to say. I don't really know. Like, yeah, it's interesting.
Yeah, that's trippy.
It brought it to another level when I noticed that the whale was actually on the check that for 9/11. It was like, oh, what?
I had a working theory for about 30 minutes that Donnie from Big Lebowski wasn't real, that he was just an imagined character. And then...
No, he's the walrus.
And then they have his ashes at the end. I'm like, oh, yeah, he had a body. So that theory got blown out of the water real quick.
Blown out of the water. Well, I was relating to it like Tool's, you know, Lateralis, when they have the whale songs right before Communication, you know, or whatever it's called. What is that song called? The one, Strengthening Our Communication, you know what I'm talking about. You're a bunch, you guys like Tool, right?
I like Tool, I'm not super familiar.
Okay, well, there's the fucking, on Lateralis, there's whale sounds for a while, and then it goes into a song about communication and strengthening communication. And I was relating to the whales communicating through sonar as if it was like, we're communicating on like a superficial level, everybody's talking, blah, blah, blah. But then there's like a resonant communication that's happening beneath that's like more, you know, underworldy or, you know, it's like the depths of the thing is actually communicating, that there's another communication happening in the midst. And like, that's, it's kind of weird, but like, that's kind of what I was taking from like it being on the check with 9/11, George Bush. It's all like, hey, we're communicating with you as whales would communicate from long distances apart through sonar.
Yeah. And earthquakes kind of work that way too. The longitudinal wave goes through the earth, and that certain equipment can pick up on that long before the earthquake hits, which is the transverse wave, right, which actually shakes, you know, the above ground. So there's this hidden flow, and it's just not seen or perceived, but it's actually the driving force of the phenomenon or something.
Yeah. It's like how Jay Kotze was talking about in Hypnosis, in the, I don't know if it's the most recent show that you had him on or what, but
I think that was the first one.
Okay. Well, he's talking about, he's trying to explain sync, and he's talking about that there's an underlying movement that's like moving. It's like there's this thing that's happening, and that like we're all relating to things on, you know, one level, but it's like these are, it's hard to explain, but it's like there's something that's moving that's not plainly visible except through these different kind of areas where it happens to be surfacing or whatever, that have a relationship. These things have a gulf, like they're not supposed to have a relationship, but you can see the relationship, and the relationship is actually expressing itself through an underlying movement. I don't know if I'm doing his words justice. I probably am not, but I was relating to it, like when he was expressing that, like it's almost like whales or something. It's like there's a underlying communication that's happening that we're, you know, only getting hints of or whatever. Kind of weird thought.
Yeah, I think he was saying, the metaphor he was thinking of was wind blowing through leaves, you know?
Yeah.
You can't really see that the wind is moving all these leaves in the same direction and, you know, blowing them around. But we understand that there's this invisible, tangible force doing it. You know, there's proof in the leaves, you know?
Right.
So I think that, yeah, he's saying sync is just like that, you know? And I think that's definitely like what I feel too, is that there's this underlying intelligence that works through human consciousness, that I think it is kind of like the human genius in some sense, but it's, to me, it's like a universal mind that operates through all these appendages, you know, and it creates this like massive thought form mandala of like mythic film, you know, psychedelic resonances and like these, you know, multitudes of expression with synchronized context and stuff, you know, and so I definitely relate to that for sure. Yeah,
I got excited when he said the thing about the wind, actually, because I was relating it to, you know, I have like the Full Circle Haunting of Julia thing I play with John Lennon albums. I don't know if you guys ever watched that, but it's pretty fucking crazy. There's this whole grand finale at the end. I play Double Fantasy, then I play Milk and Honey, which wasn't released while he was alive, but it was what they were working on. And then the Instant Karma EP, which is Instant Karma on one side, and then it's Who Has Seen the Wind on the other. And so when you're watching the end of this film, there's this whole, what it's communicating in terms of the spirit, like you can't see the spirit. I mean, this is what's happening in the movie. Like you're seeing something that you're not supposed to see. So it's like, this isn't something that would be visible, but it's real nonetheless. I mean, there's influences, spiritual influences on our reality, or, you know, whatever, you know, this is the nature of the thing, is that there's these different energies, and the energies are, you can see their effects, but you can't see them, which is something like Crowley expressed a lot. Yeah, you can see the result of the thing, but you can't see the thing. So just like you see wind brushing. So it's Yoko Ono saying, who has seen the wind? Neither you nor I, you know, but when the trees bow down their heads, whatever, it's like, expressing that we see this, but we don't see that. And so, like, when Jake was talking about that, I was really like, oh, wow, yeah, totally, man. That's like, because that was one of the sinkiest fucking things I've come across, so, in the first place.
That's cool.
Yeah. It's a classic metaphor, I guess.
I have no answer to this question, but does sink suggest determinism to you?
No, absolutely not.
Well, yeah, I mean, belief is deterministic, right?
It's relative. It's not, you can't take an ultimate position in that way.
No, because
it's because
relativity is still deterministic. If you're going to talk about like relativity as far as it's defined in Einsteinian relativity, there's still an objective ground that's deterministic.
Within its own dynamic, it still is, has...
Well, there's simultaneity, which says everyone sees something different, but there's still determinism in that fundamentally everything is getting pushed and pulled by forces that can be measured and known, and everything is just...
Oh, then in that
machine,
sense. But then
who's
gonna fucking determine it? If you could argue that there's the idea that, like, a dog watching a chess game can't understand the fucking chess game, whereas, like, we are looking up at another chess game and can't understand it, you know, it's like, what level of intelligence is required to actually see the true determinism of the thing?
Right.
You could infer that, and you could say, it's ridiculous, actually, that I said absolutely not. I would actually say relatively not, which is probably that's not actually answering anything, but.
No, I get you.
Yeah.
No, I'm just curious. It comes into my mind now, and I don't think the question can ever be answered, not through the human nervous system and not through what experience tells us, because we're still hopelessly confused.
Let's ask Jason. Jason, determinism, sync, is it determinism?
Well, he stepped away. I don't know if he's gone or not.
Oh, I didn't read that. Oh, I gotta go for a second. Be right back.
We'll drop it on him after the fact. It's fine.
Yeah, we'll drop that shit on him. You know that there's that classic sample. I don't know where it came from or what, but it's like, you know, some of the music we play isn't necessarily geared for your bumping enjoyment. It's geared for you to think. For those of you out there who don't think too much, I'm just telling you about that shit before we drop it on you. And it's like, come on with the track. I've heard it a couple different times or from a few different places. You guys ever heard that before?
I haven't.
No, it's great.
But though. No, it makes, and it even makes sense with some stuff that we put out, because it's not always like...
This isn't geared for your bumping enjoyment.
Right, sometimes it's more contemplative, sometimes it actually has different dynamics to it. So, yeah, there's that element to any form of artwork. It's sometimes it's a, hey, there's something to really be contemplating, and then something just to kind of blow up your senses a bit. And so there's something to both experiences, right? There's the sensation, and then there's the conscious contemplation of it. So they go hand in hand, mm-hmm. And I guess that's like the magical way, right? There's a spirituality or an aestheticism, or not aestheticism, esoteric quality, but it's about living your life, right? You were talking about Crowley, and he just lived life, and I noticed that with a lot of people that just are willing to engage with their unconscious. They're like, yeah, okay, there's more to it, so what does that mean? It means be more present and do stuff I like to do.
I had a weird processing thing recently, and I'm sure you guys are probably already like, oh, well, yeah, maybe. But you know, like, when you're looking at the Tree of Life and you see that the pathway that connects Chesed to Gevurah is for, like, you know, the Europeans, they would equate that with the strength card, right? Lust, which we would say 77 because of Oz. Oz is strength. We have this whole connection. 77 holding together the tree kind of deal, the force that keeps the tree in place as it exists. And you've heard me go on that spiel, I'm sure, a bunch. But I was just thinking about, I forgot until recently that I guess it's, if you spell out Pan in Greek, it equals 77 as well, as is pointed out in Crowley's 777. Is that correct, Kevin?
I'm pretty sure, yeah. I think I feel like I've read that, but I can't say for sure.
Right. Well, I was tripping out on that because for multiple reasons, and it's a lot to get into, but I was thinking that Pan literally is the all, right? And if you're looking at Pan also as a dweller on the threshold, there's this kind of reasonable theory. If Jason, are you here? Okay. Jason would probably know about this more than I, maybe, but with Jesus's transfiguration, it apparently happened on Mount Hermon, is what they attribute the mountain to, is what they people who look at the area and the where it would be at that point, where, you know, they're like, oh, well, if he's on a mountain, what mountain would this be? Mount Hermon is for Hermes. Hermes is the father of Pan, and so the base of this mountain was dedicated to Pan worship during that time. And so there's this whole idea of kind of like his transfiguration on the mountain being symbolic of the dweller on the threshold, and like that his father in this case is actually Hermes. So it's like Pan communicating with his father, where he says, you know, I and the father are one. They're relating to it, to this Judaic thing, but it also seems to be expressing this, what would be considered pagan, because this mountain is dedicated to pagan worship, right? Or what would be considered pagan worship. Pagan just means civilian or whatever. But anyways, so I was relating that pathway and thinking about, well, if you're saying that it's the same, that if you're saying that that's 77, you're equating it with strength, and then, you know, Oz, and then you're like, well, this is the rainbow that stands below it, right, Kevin? You know, you have the whole, all the spheroes make up the rainbow. then it's like,
right.
It's literally, he is the all. So it's like, how appropriate then that you should equate that pathway not only with Joaquin and Boaz, the Oz of Joaquin, you know what I'm saying? Like the strength that's holding it together is established in strength, and this is the establishment. But then to equate it then with Pan, which is literally the all, and it's all, it's encompassing everything below it because everything is contained at one point. It was tripping me the fuck out because I already was like, wow, that's really crazy on all these different levels, and getting into like nerding out on like the whiz and shit with the fucking, you know, replication of the Kabbaz, the sphere between them and all of this stuff. Right. And then over the rainbow and the rainbow bridge and that whole trip. But then I was like, wow, Pan is literally a panorama. He could just as easily be equated with the rainbow because he's everything. And so I was like, of all the places that that could be attributed to on the tree, wow, that's really potent. You dig it?
Right. Yeah, definitely.
And what was the path again? Because I think Jason got back, but
between Chesed and Gevurah.
Okay.
I was just pointing out that the Europeans equate the pathway between Chesed and Gevurah as like strength or lust, and that we associate that with 77, well, synchronistically speaking.
Well, he appears with the Old Testament prophets, so you could say that Chesed and Gevurah are the two Old Testament figures of mercy and severity, and then he's the man of Tifereth in the middle.
Right. I mean, if you're going to apply the patriarchs to the Sphirot, that's another level to the thing, which is worth doing. But that wasn't necessarily where I was going with it, but I'm open to that, yeah.
Oh, right. And then you get a bit of a Gnostic element to it.
Yeah. Well, that one gets really interesting, but they change so much. And that's what gets really challenging is like, it doesn't seem like they're entirely consistent about, you know, even from one person, oftentimes, it seems like they switch who the patriarchs are relating to in terms of Sphirot, and so I don't always know
right. What
to do with that. I mean, there's certain ones that are standard, I guess.
Well, David.
Yes, sir.
What is, like, the book I should read if I want the pre-Western occult version of Kabbalah that is, like, the best text I could find that it's not going to overwhelm me?
Well, there isn't one that's not going to overwhelm you.
Okay, how about
if it's the best text?
So be it, but I guess like something well-rounded.
Yeah, there's one, I actually sent it to Jason a while ago, and then you commented, Jason, that it was too expensive, which I couldn't agree more, but at the same time, it's like, hey, if you want the book, it's, what is it called, Paths of Light or something like that? Who was that? Do you know what I'm talking about? It's 12th century, I know that. God, what's that guy's name? Do you know what I'm talking about, Jason? Well, I sent it to you a long time ago. I guess like maybe 5 months ago or something.
Paths of Light.
I have to look it up again. I can find it. I'll get back to you on that.
Okay, that's fine.
There's the Sefer Yetzirah. Anything by Kaplan I would recommend. I'd actually recommend Meditations on Kabbalah. That would be a really good one. By Kaplan. R.E.A. Kaplan.
Yeah, okay.
I have this book that I actually have two copies of it. I'd be happy to mail one over to you. I can't remember the title. It's something like Meditations and Kabbalah or something, but it's a really nice like walkthrough of the history of the Kabbalah and the tree, and then all the different concepts that apply to the tree. And it's all meant to be very practical and kind of like integrated into daily life kind of stuff. So it's definitely like,
are you sure that's not R.E.A. Kaplan?
Let me check it out. It's right in my room over here because it's, I got it in this bin outside a bookstore. And they were a dollar, because I guess they had so many copies laying around. Here we go. It's called Total Kabbalah by Maggie Whitehouse.
Cool. Oh, yeah, it's called Gates of Light.
Gates of Light.
Yeah, by Joseph Ben Abraham Gicatilia.
Sounds like a yes.
Gicatilla. I thought it was Gicatilia, but I don't know. But that's, yeah, that's the one. Gates of Light. This is like a celebrated, you know, Kabbalistic masterpiece, whatever, you know.
Okay, thank you.
Sure. People are charging for it. Garden of Pomegranates is highly, 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 highly recommended. That's who I study, is Roma. Moshe Rabbeinu. That's what, you know, Israel Regarde took the title from. That book is incredible. It's written by this guy who was in his 20s.
Oh.
There's a whole thing around that where it's like he had to dig up his teacher's body, who had been buried with all his writings, to do commentary on it and stuff.
What?
It's like really crazy, yeah.
Whoa.
Jesus Christ.
No, Jesus wasn't actually involved in this one.
Not
as
this
far
one.
As I know.
He's everywhere all the time. It's like Santa Claus. He's always watching.
God, that's terrifying. What the fucking kind of terrifying shit we tell our fucking kids? What the fuck? He's always watching you. No one sees Santa Claus, but Santa Claus sees everyone. That's like the spookiest, Sandman-y kind of shit.
I dropped on my father recently. I'm like, I don't even know if Jesus exists and or existed as a real man. And I forgot, like, what dropping scary information on someone to treasure something so much.
Right, you don't see it until you challenge it or until you, you know, provoke it. Then it's all like, whoa, shit.
Yes, and it just makes you realize what you take for granted in your own, like, constellation of ideas. It's like, yeah, I could believe this, or I could believe he was real. It's whatever.
There was a bunch of Jesuses, man. Right. They were everywhere.
Yeah, it's
oh, Jesus on every soapbox to the next fucking, you know?
Yeah, oh, Dionysus and Zoroastar were, I guess, put there by the devil. That's the only answer. That's the only answer we have, or all these other archetypes, or Green Man, or whatever.
You guys know about the fucking, what was I looking at? The Devil's Bible, or whatever they call it, which is ridiculous that they call it that.
Right.
The Codex Gigas, or whatever. Probably pronounced
it. Yeah, I've seen something about that.
Do you know about that, Jason?
Probably.
It's Codex Gigas, I think it's a G-I-G-A.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow, what a trippy fucking book. And you know that it's got that fucking eight-pointed star on the front, which is, you know, it's all, Nicole Kidman. It's just, it looked really interesting. There's like there's this classic image of the devil on one side, and there's like the kingdom on the other, and the whole thing is about duality or whatever. But it's like one of the biggest books ever written, which is why it has the name that it has, which basically means really large book or whatever. But it's got the Old and New Testament, I guess, but then it's got like, conjurations next to the Psalms in another language, and then it's got like apparently it takes the text of Josephus Flavius and puts it with the New Testament, which I find really kind of backing up to the I don't know exactly how it's done, so I don't know the full degree of it, but it seems to back up Joseph Atwill's theory, not everything that he extrapolates from it, but at least the basic idea that Josephus Flavius's text and the New Testament are actually meant to be united, you know, which has its own set of implications that you can take what you will from.
Well, before the Testimonium Flavium, where he mentions Christ debatably in that.
Totally debatably.
There's, yeah. There's this weird little anecdote that he has about this Jewish girl getting impregnated by someone in the Temple of Isis. And the whole thing kind of reads like an allegory for Christianity. She's impregnated by like a Roman. Hold on.
So it's as if her child is the church or whatever?
Well, so it's like you've got this Jewish mother and then a Roman father, and then the baby is Christianity.
Hmm. Interesting. It's fucking, it's Egypt and what, it's their illegitimate son. It's fucked up.
Right. So, I'm sorry, I'm looking for it here.
You should have had this pre-prepared, Jason. You knew it was going to go in this direction.
Yeah. My only problem with Atwill is on certain matters, he gets pretty dogmatic. He's like, oh yeah, Shakespeare was definitely a woman. That's just, I mean, that's an interesting theory, and maybe there's some.
Did Atwill say that? I don't remember.
Yeah,
that.
That's one of his running theories.
Oh, but not in Caesar's Messiah.
No. No. Those don't fit together that well. But just the fact that these things crystallize into belief systems just because it's something you've researched or something. I don't know. That's always the danger of research, right? It's like, oh, I'm really interested in this. And then you feel like by the end of it, you've learned so much about it that it's just an interest. Now you feel like you have to believe it or something. And there's all this evidence that will verify a totally opposite belief system if you went and you spend time with that. And so it's kind of asinine, some of it, of what he says. But Caesar's Messiah has something to add to the conversation, for sure. I don't know if it's certainly not the whole story, but there's probably some insight into the writings of the time and what that was trying to communicate.
I was mostly only interested in one thing that he was doing to back up his theory, which was just literally taking probability theory and applying it mathematically in, like, a rational way. It was rational. You know?
Well, sure, but I mean,
it doesn't prove his point, but what it did prove is that there's some connection between these books. that shouldn't be there in all on its own. Like, I mean, if it is on its own, then that's a real mind fuck.
Did he get a statistician to do it?
Yeah, it's total statistic. Like, yeah, he worked it out or whatever. And so it's in there. You'd have to, you know,
sure. Read it for yourself. I bet it was honest. With any kind of number stuff, if it's in like a history book or something.
Yeah,
a science journal, I have issues.
Check out yourself. And it's still like, it's a thing. It's like he's proving that this connection exists between these books. Literally the most interesting for me was just between the four books of the gospel themselves, mm-hmm. the way that one will fill in the blank of the other one. And so you're like, well, if these were in fact completely isolated things, they shouldn't do that to that degree, you know? Mm.
Yeah, I get that point of view. It's not completely wrong. It's just not convincing to me. But it's, interesting and worth looking into. And that's what all it is. You know, something was funny to me on Facebook. Someone put like a picture of Xena LeVay or Xena Shrek next to Taylor Swift. And they're pretty
close. I did that.
You did it. Fucking A. That was awesome.
No. Why
did that strike you? I mean, like, how did you get to that? That just struck you one day.
Well, it's the blonde girl being in the Church of Satan again, as where the luminous blonde locks are the solar light that is really the part of Satan's realm.
Ah,
so is that what's happening in fucking Melancholia, and why it connects to Antichrist in the specific way that it does in terms of Charlotte Gainsbourg?
I don't know.
Because I was tripping it, because in other words, like, if you watch Melancholia, I'm sure, you, knowing you, you're like, right away, you got two sisters, one with the blood, obviously.
Right, so one is Taylor Swift and one's Katy Perry, and they've got some bad blood between each other.
Right, but I mean, like, there seemed to be something very, like, deep being communicated, and as far as I could tell, like, it seemed like Kirsten Dunst was, like, the Aryan, like, whatever, like she's like the symbol, and then it's like you have a French Jew who's obviously like, and he seems to be making that trilogy, you know, Antichrist, Melancholia, and Nymphomaniac as like a statement on like, you know, his feelings on Zionism and all this stuff, you know, which he himself is like seems to admit to. I mean, that's, it doesn't, you know, it's like his main focus. And so it's like, is this like a fucking, like, he's like, oh, you got all these, you know, Hollywood Jews playing around with Kabbalah and doing all this different stuff. Steven Spielberg asked him to do his Holocaust movie after he saw Europa, which is interesting in and of itself, sync-wise, because that's one of the moons of Jupiter. I could go on about that. But I watch Melancholia, and, you know, I see it with Smashing Pumpkins, you know, Melancholia and the Infinite Sadness. I don't know if you guys ever got a chance to watch that, but it's pretty incredible.
Dude, we did it. We did a whole show on it.
Right, but at that point when we did the show on it, I hadn't had it up on the internet. I don't know if you guys saw that with it, because it's like it's like very specific with timing, more than most things.
Okay.
It's pretty crazy.
I tried to edit it together myself.
Right, it's the 24th second of the film. You tried to edit it yourself together, really?
Yeah, I tried to mux it together with MKV tool mix.
Oh, really? Okay. But yeah, no, there's this whole thing going on with the fucking, what were you saying about her? Because I was like, there's a song that's We Only Come Out at Night, and so like, you know, in that film when there's like the evening when Charlotte Gainsbourg is like losing her breath and the planet does it's when it does its first loop before it comes back around, and it's like the sun comes out and then the song starts of We Only Come Out at Night, the day is much too bright, and it's all like this bright day and she's all covering her eyes, and it seemed to be relating to vampire, like the world is a vampire, which is another song. And then how many people in that fucking movie have played vampires? It's just ridiculous. We talked about this when we talked about the thing. But like, I don't know. I was like going into this whole deal with what was being communicated in terms of the black hair with the shadows and the light hair, but what was also being said about, like, I don't know, culturally and all of this different stuff is really, really weird. I mean, I definitely, like, if there is an Antichrist in the film Antichrist, it seems to be her. But then you got William Dafoe was Jesus Christ in The Last Temptation of Christ, which felt like no accident for him to then be there. But then in Nymphomaniac, he's her fucking boss, which has this, and then he's like the devil or something in that way. Like, it's really kind of weird. Like, who's the devil in Nymphomaniac? It seems to be William Dafoe. But yeah, it was weird. Not to say that the devil is the Antichrist, you know. That would be crazy. I can't. I'm looking through your Josephus Flavius thing, but I can't find that where that story would have been. This is huge.
I gave you the link. If you want to go back to something classy.
I mean, I went to your link.
In the Temple of Isis, right after the story about Jesus. He's got the story about a woman in the temple of Isis who gets seduced by this Roman guy in a mask.
Weird.
And then after that, he's got this other one about this guy who was a Jew who had transgressed the law, and it just sounds like it's talking about Paul.
Huh.
Like the section 5 sounds like it's talking about Paul. So I don't know. That's my little bit on Josephus here.
Yeah. You're breaking up a little bit, but I think it's because of activity. Look at it, all this shit. So I'm going to close some windows here and hope that straightens things out.
Dude, my computer is like 9 years old. What's going on with yours?
Yeah, mine's pretty old, I guess. Not 9. Well, that's like in dog years. In computer years, that's a very old computer.
Thank you for listening to this broadcast from the SyncBook Radio. If you enjoyed this episode, there's so much more content waiting for you at thesyncbook.com. Tune in to our other SyncBook Radio programs, 42 Minutes, Always Record, The Marty Leeds Mathematical Radio Hour, Synchronize, Pentimental, and Sync Quick News. Our newest episodes are always free, and members get access to our full archive of over 600 hours. You'll find all of this, as well as our books and videos, at thesyncbook.com.
Well, I went to the doctor and said I'm feeling kind of rough. Let me break it to you, son. Your shit's fucked up. I said my shit's fucked up. I don't see how. He said the shit that used to work won't work now. Shot to hell. Yeah, my shit's fucked up. It has to happen to the best of us. And the rich folks suffer like the rest of us. It'll happen to you. Fucked up shit. Yeah, my shit's fucked up.